This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org, elmad.pardes.org.
Hi, everybody. This is Tzvi Hirschfield. I am sitting in Jerusalem right now at the wonderful Pardes Institute, and it is my privilege not only to be sitting here, but to be sitting here with my friend and colleague, Rabbi Mike Foyer, who is, among other things, a teacher of Jewish thought here at the Pardes Institute, and he does other great things as well. He is the education director at Yeshivat Sulam Yaakov, and he also is an educational content consultant. So Mike's involved in a lot of different interesting projects, and he agreed to spend a little time with me today to learn a little Torah with me, which I'm always grateful for and excited about. Mike, you want to tell us a little bit about the text that you've chosen for us today and what we're going to be learning?
Sure. The text I chose is from Rav Kook. And, you know, Rav Kook, most people, if they know his name, recognize him as the first chief rabbi of the Palestine Mandate. He came to Eretz Yisrael at the beginning of the 20th century, and he really brought with him both deep roots in traditional yeshiva culture, as well as Hasidic culture. On his mother's side, he came from a very important Chabad family. He was one of the star students of the yeshiva in Volozhin, and very close to the Netziv, very famous Rosh Hashiva there. But he also brought with him the waves of change that were rocking Jewish Europe at that time and the Jewish Enlightenment, and a real sense that there was an imminent redemption. So he's his works are a passion of mine. And what I chose is from a book which is fairly unique amongst his writings. It's called Le Nouveau Hador, for the lost or the confused of the generation. It's a play on words from the Rambam's Moren LeNevuchim, his guide to the perplexed. And it's special because it is, amongst all the works of Rav Kook we have, the only one which was actually written as a book. In 1903, right before he came to the land of Israel, and not only was it written as a book, but it was never published. It lay in manuscript, hidden away, so to speak, up until about somewhere between 5 and 10 years ago. I don't know exactly, I could look at the publishing. Between 5 and 10 years ago, Rav Shachan Rahmani brought the book out of manuscript with the attempt to try to bring it to the world, and it deals with many controversial issues, and therefore he actually received quite a bit of flack from the students of Rav Tzvi Yehuda, Rav Kook's son. Nevertheless, he labored through his PhD in the publication to show that the thoughts that are here are actually central to Rav Kook, even though the book itself was never published. And I, amongst that book, chose a particular piece about the building of the temple, and not just about the building of the temple, but about what is, in the Torah's mind, the classic, the central act of the temple worship, which is the korbanot, the sacrifices. And I really chose it for two reasons. Number one, because as an educator, I'm always looking to break assumptions. And I think that you say the word sacrifice to most people, and if they have any context at all, it's a bit of a sort of recoiling difficulty. Even amongst my experience, religious Jews who nominally see themselves as adhering to the mitzvah, the idea of serving God by slaughtering goats is not an easy one. The other one is that I've been a vegetarian for 20 years. And the question of our relationship to God, our relationship to each other as human beings, and the role that animals play in that, in this strange sacrificial service, is it bothers me. And I feel that Rav Kook's thoughts on it are redemptive, in the sense that they open up new horizons and show a path to a future which can actually make us better people.
Okay, that sounds great. I was going to add that I think for most of our listeners, you say sacrifice and they think of the batter bunting to advance the runner from first base to second. But Louise is from England. She doesn't get that reference. Mike, are you a baseball fan?
I grew up in Cleveland when the Indians were like a bad joke. So no, I never was so into it.
I'm the only one in this room right now that got that joke, but I'm going to stick with it because I like it. Okay, so how about we jump in and we're going to read and then translate a few key passages, and then we're going to see what emerges here, what's interesting, and we'll see, we'll share our thoughts, and Mike will share his thoughts.
Okay, so I'm starting off here. It says HaKorbanot, right? The sacrifices. Amnam Vadai. כל זמן שמצב המוסר האנושי מוצא להכרח או לישר לפניו, right? It says, in truth, it's certain that so long as the moral situation of humanity finds it necessary, or at least right, Lishtamesh l'tarchav ha-chomerim b'harigat balei chayim. To use for its physical needs the death of animals. So insofar as that's where humanity's at, then it's fitting that the usage, the most fundamental usage of anything, dahainu, horat ha-kara ha-pnimit, mechovat ha-hota'a le'el ha-tov. So what's the most fundamental usage of anything in creation? It's to teach this deep inner recognition of one's obligation to give thanks for the goodness of God. So it's important that Rav Kook is saying that that is actually why physicality exists at all. So insofar as we use animals, the death of animals, for our physical needs, then it is appropriate that the death of animals be used for the most fundamental need, which is to recognize the goodness, and recognize and give thanks for the goodness of God. Then it's going to happen through the sacrifice of animals. And he goes on, right? It might just be that during that period, that will actually last. Because remember, Rav Kook is speaking in a context where the sacrifices have ceased now for 2,000 years, and he's dreaming about what it will be if they come back. Right? Right? And then there'll be a moral elevation to the point where that type of act would actually be nauseous. It would be repulsive to all humanity. He goes on, I'm just gonna skip the next line because he develops that thought about the nature of cruelty in the world and the potential for humanity to really stumble in the face of that cruelty, and therefore the need for shmirah, for guarding against falling into a lowness of morality. And he picks up here, he says, Al-Kain, as long as that's a danger, tia harat ha-korbanot, the arousal of the sacrifices, meaning that which the sacrifices awaken within us, shepulat, shepoelet al-kol panim, al-amitasek eizo hara, sheyesh tzorcha daim b'midat ha-din ba'olam. The impact, like I said, the awakening that the korbanot cause, at the very least in those who are involved in them. And remember that in the time of the temple, this was, I wouldn't call it a spectator sport, but to build on your baseball image, this was the stadium of the Jewish world. Everyone was focused on the actions that were happening there, right? And what will it come to teach? That there is a need for midat din ba'olam, for this aspect of judgment, for the ability to draw lines, to make sharp distinctions, and to hold boundaries. So long as that's the moral state of humanity, that we see a need to use the death of animals for our own physical needs, there's a danger, a moral danger in that. And therefore, we must also apply that rule to the service of God and generating that inner awareness of our gratitude.
So two things came up for me in listening to that explanation. First, it's very interesting that he's talking about humanity and not Jews. This idea that even though these sacrifices are happening in the temple in Jerusalem, he's talking about sort of the moral place of all of humanity and not the Jewish people. That's one thing that really came up for me, I think, is very, very interesting for me. And to hear to listen to an Orthodox rabbi speak about the purposefulness of these activities and not just sort of see them as, well, of course we have to do them. God commanded them and that then they're timeless and that'll always be there. But to talk about the purpose, why we're doing these sacrifices in the first place. And is that unusual? Is that something we wouldn't expect to find among most traditional theologians? So those are the two things I'm curious to hear your thoughts about.
So the first, I think, is consistent with Rav Kook's thought, because Rav Kook is a universalist in a truly Jewish sense. I mean, he's not a universalist in the 20th century sense of homogenizing the world and making everything the same. He's a universalist in the sense that he really believes that the particularism, which is embedded in the Torah, in the Jewish people's identity, the temple, I mean, don't get more particular than that. Only a priest can pass a certain boundary. And even amongst the priests, only some can do certain things, you know. But it's in service of the whole. And he believes in another way that the Jewish people are a living part, a living heart to humanity as a whole. Our mission is to humanity as a whole. It's not to the Jewish people. And you can't separate the moral state of the Jewish people from humanity or that of humanity from the Jewish people. So therefore, absolutely, he is working for the sake of humanity as a whole here. The second question, in terms of the nature, the purposefulness, as you said, the intentionality of the sacrifices, we could go back to classical sources, the debate between the Rambam, Maimonides, and the Ramban, Nachmanides. And the Rambam, in his Guide to the Perplexed, seems to imply, and I say it that way because it really depends on how you read it, but seems to imply that the sacrifices were technical acts, that the details of each particular korban, each offering, were not intrinsically important. Whereas the Ramban, Nachmanides, leaps on him and says, it's not possible. God, you know, to borrow a phrase, wouldn't have us just read the phone book for its own sake. That each of these actions is meant to cultivate within us an awareness. And because the Ramban was a mystic, he also believed it was somehow arousing something in the divine. What's important to me here is that you'll notice, of course, what was this not about? It wasn't about God. Right? It's striking through this whole passage how the one thing which you would think, he did mention that what's meant to be cultivated within humanity is the awareness of the obligation for gratitude toward God, based in our physical experience and the korbanot as this sort of height of physical experience, but it's not about God, which in that sense, he's following in the footsteps of the prophets. I mean, we just, not so long ago, passed that amazing vision of Isaiah where he said, these sacrifices are not for me. Right? So
God was saying that through Isaiah.
Yeah, so the prophet's saying that in the voice of God. So I think in that sense, Rav Kook certainly has one foot in the prophetic vision.
And what is your take on this idea of human moral development? Is he referring to a natural process? It's we evolve naturally to grow better, or is this something that could happen but doesn't by definition happen? There's a sense here that Rav Kook is a modernist, sort of believing that this sort of necessary advance. And I'm just sort of wondering, in a post-Holocaust generation, you know, what do we think about this idea? Are we really getting better? Is morality advancing among humanity? What's your take on that? How do you respond to some of that?
So the first thing I would say is that I believe Rav Kook ultimately is an educator. And so therefore, he believes in the potential of human moral evolution. I don't think he sees it as inevitable, right? And so therefore, the Torah is a great gift to humanity in the sense that it gives us both a context and the tools for that evolution, but is not an inevitability by any means. And I agree with you, in the post-Holocaust world, it's hard to take a simplistic view of the progress of humanity. There's no question there. Nevertheless, I believe that the very cruelty and the cheapness of blood that the Holocaust really indicates, and we don't have to go so far as the Holocaust, and we could go 100 miles or less north of here, and we could see the slaughter that's been going on in Syria for years now as the world yawns, right? We could look even closer to the very real difficulties that we have here in our own land in finding some means of living together with another people, right? That the challenges lie in the right application of this midat hadin, that power to draw distinctions, which is, don't forget, Rav Kook said, as long as humanity is in the moral state where I could look at an animal and see lunch, as opposed to seeing life and an expression of the will of the Creator, then there is a need to draw distinctions about what life is available for my use and what is not. And I can tell you, as a 20 years as a vegetarian and in a religious community where oftentimes I've been confronted by people telling me that I'm obligated to eat meat, you know, which I find not only inaccurate, but downright offensive, right? And I've never taken the stance, not internally and not with others, that meat is murder, which is a whole different discourse. That's not my perspective. My perspective began outside of my religious life and in becoming religious, found a home in Rav Kook's vision that ultimately humanity is meant to be, as we saw in the story of creation, the steward of the creation, of the Ula Shamra, to serve and to protect. And so therefore, moral evolution is possible, but because it's possible and not necessary, it's not a teleology, it's not an inevitability that's moving, so then failure is also always possible.
So if I understand what you're saying in this text correctly, and Both are probably questionable, Louise, at this point. But number one, it seems that this is not about animal rights. This is not about protecting animals, per se. This is about how human beings can morally grow or what tools we need, depending on what moral state we're in. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that occurred to me is, how would you respond then to a student who says, wait, if this is about preventing cruelty or containing human cruelty, might be the better term, what about someone who says, but I find killing animals to be cruel?
So the first one, it's certainly not about animal rights, because Rav Kook didn't believe in human rights either. There is no word for rights in the Torah. Modern Hebrew had to borrow a word and change its meaning. In modern Hebrew, rights are zchuyot, which really mean merits, right? Because the Torah's perspective is one of obligations. Right? What are my obligations? If I own property, we could talk in the Western discourse about property rights, right? But really, the Torah says, no, you own an ox, here are your obligations. If it does this, if it does that, how do you have to take care of it? What's called shmirah. And you'll notice that posture of guarding was very central to the statements we just read. So it's not about animal rights, but it is absolutely about humanity's obligation to creation as a whole, as a vessel for our relation to the Creator. And so therefore, here, he's commenting on the low moral development, which God recognized by giving us the permission to eat meat. But nevertheless, in the ideal and elsewhere in Rav Kook's writing, he speaks at length about the fact that that in Gan Eden, we were vegetarians, which is the Edenic ideal of vision of the relationship of humanity to creation as a whole, and that it was only after the failure of the flood that God gave permission, a concession, to the moral degradation of humanity. Right. And so that it's not about rights in that standard discourse. Nevertheless, it is about our obligation to creation as a whole. In terms of the cruelty, Rav Kook, cruelty is a corruption of Minat Adin. Cruelty is a corruption of the ability to draw distinctions, because if I heartlessly draw distinctions, you know, much evil has been done in the world in service of clarity of thought and definitions, right? Right? Loving humanity and not caring about people is a very common form that such a intellectual stance takes. So Rav Kook believes, as always, because his one of his roots in learning is in the mystical realm, and what's called hamtakat adinim, right? The sweetening of judgment and the refinement of human character. Because getting rid of cruelty is not the same thing as getting rid of the ability to draw distinctions. So if a student said to me, it's cruel to kill animals, I would say, well, let's take that statement apart. I mean, if you just believe taking their life is cruel altogether, we have to define what's cruel. Is it the fact that things die cruel? I personally empathize with that, but I am very worried by what Rav Kook calls the limited moral capacity of humanity. It's much easier to love sheep than it is to love people, right? And his fear, and one of the reasons he did not advocate vegetarianism as a this world, this time period stance, was because he knew that for many people that it would be a distraction from the real obligation to love human beings, which is much harder, right? So it might be cruel, but this is exactly what he's saying. It's an outlet for the reality of the fact that we live in a cruel world whose ultimate purpose is to generate within us a gratitude toward God for giving us the world in the first place, is a critical piece in the moral evolution. Can I give you one more image that might be a little uncomfortable? Do you eat meat?
I do. I happily eat meat. I'm afraid to admit here publicly. Yeah.
Have you ever participated in a slaughter?
No. Actually, that's not true. I observed the slaughter of fowl, which was not particularly challenging to look at. But I understand that cows and sheep are a much different story.
So I've actually held the sheep down on the ground while the shochet slit its throat, and ended up, you know, covered in all the things that come out of an animal when you actually take its life. And like I said, I've been a vegetarian for 20 years. I had no intention of eating this animal whatsoever. But one of the things that struck me more than anything else was the look on the face of the meat eaters. We were all planning on eating this animal when we were done. This look of horror. How did I end up in that position? Is because when the shochet said somebody grab the sheep and bring it over off the flatbed, nobody else would go near it. And, you know, with all the cruelty in the world, right, it is always interesting to me that you know, there's rivers of blood that flow through our society. They're just pushed off to the margins where we can't see them. The average meat eater thinks that meat comes from the supermarket. And to connect it to the loss of life is uncomfortable, and therefore we don't. What Rav Kook is saying is that there's a direct relationship between that and our uncaring attitude to the death that's happening in Syria, to the death that happens around the corner, right? That if we blunt ourselves and are willing to serve our physical needs with the death of animals, but are unable to recognize that that same need needs to be oriented toward God through the sacrifices, then in a false attempt to make a nicety of the world, we allow real cruelty in. And it prevents the evolution that he's speaking about.
Okay, let's take a look at a couple more sentences here and then go on in the text. Go ahead, Michael. You can read.
So I want to just jump forward, if you're looking at the text, to where it starts, V'chevan, Omnum kishiyitro meim ha-matzav ad ofen ha-yoter nizgav. Right? He says, in truth, when the situation is lifted up to its most lofty character, when there will no longer be a need to guard the moral state of humanity, then it's certain that the great Sanhedrin, right? And it's important to remember that the halachic system within which we live is so broken, because there is no real central living body that can adjudicate reality on the level in which it demands. But it's part of Rav Kook's vision, that great court sitting in the place which God will choose, which is, of course, already been identified as Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. Yamiku b'Torah, they're going to dig deep in the Torah. Im yitaken lezabeach, az l'Hashem kochai. If it's even possible to sacrifice an animal to God, then why? Kasher ein ha'adam yachol lirtzot bazeh b'shum ofen mitzad hakarato ha'musari. If humanity cannot in any way find satisfaction in such an act because of their moral clarity, the ne'ema, and it's because it says in the Torah, l'ritzonchem tizbachu, right? Because you shall offer these sacrifices according to your will. So Rav Kook is saying that once humanity reaches the point where there is no need to guard against cruelty, right? And therefore, we would look at an animal, and this is not within our moral compass to kill such a thing. Remember, not to eat. Certainly not to sacrifice. Then he's saying that the Sanhedrin would look and say, well, this is not what the Torah is asking of us. The Torah is asking us, the ritzon chen tizbachu, right? You should sacrifice it according to your will. And if it's no longer our will, then, according to Rav Kook, it's no longer a sacrifice. It's just spilling blood. Right? V'kevan she... And since it's not possible then there should be any wholeness to human desire in that context, right? It will certainly be within the power of the high court to switch the offerings, the sacrifices of animals to that of meal offerings from vegetables. And this is why there's this sort of final stage of consciousness spoken of in the Navi Malachi, right there at the end of the book of prophets, that what's going to be sweet to God? The mincha, the meal offering which comes from Yehuda in Yerushalayim. Davcha mincha v'lo zevach. Right? It's specifically the meal offering, says Rav Kook, and not an animal sacrifice. And here you see that his vision of moral evolution is rooted in his understanding of the text. This is not the abandonment of Torah in the face of his own personal moral conceptions, nor is it judicial activism in an attempt to somehow make the Torah more palatable to society as it is. The role that the Beit Din is meant to play in the evolution of humanity, and that the Torah is not some abstraction which is meant to shoehorn us into something which we are not, but is rather the primary educational pillar on which we're supposed to build the world to become who we're meant to be.
But there's still implicit here, I think, at least, so I think there is a judicial activism here. I agree, it's not imposed. It's not the idea of, you know, wise men in an ivory tower saying we think society should be this way, but it's saying that when we do evolve and change, and not only that, when we have the confidence that our change is actually growth, not just that we're different, but that we've actually morally improved, it is going to be the job of religious leadership to say, seeing that, then we have to understand Torah differently for who's in front of us now. And I mean, I think for some folks out there, this is mind-blowing. And I'm wondering, you know, what's your sense of that? Have you ever been with anybody strictly Orthodox who reads this and says, it can't be, this is impossible, freaks out, goes out and has a big meat sandwich to protest?
Well, first of all, I want to clarify, that's not judicial activism you described. Judicial activism means that the court decides whether society is ready or not, this is where we're going. And then if they're a responsible court, hopefully they're ahead of the curve and they're pulling society along with them. Here is, you, I think, described wonderfully accurately, what the court is doing is actually looking at the reality, judging it, as you said correctly, to be growth and heading in the direction that the prophets understood was our destination. And then expressing the law in a way which was such. In terms of your second question, I think many people are deeply uncomfortable. Many Orthodox Jews in particular are deeply uncomfortable with this. This type of perspective for any number of reasons, but not the least of which, and here we might be getting into deep waters that are best swum another time.
Go, start swimming.
But you know, Rav Kook in his historical writings, especially in Ma'alach HaIdiot B'Yisrael, his the journey of ideas through Israel, which is his great historical work. It's attached as the end of part of the end of Orot, if you want to look for where it is. Clearly states that religion as we know it is a product of exile. Right? It is a product of exile. And that's a big statement. I'm going to leave it hanging there. But the implication, therefore, then is that redemption will involve another step of evolution. Right? And in that respect, the way I've learned to think of it is that the Torah that we've carried forward through exile is a seed. And it has been planted. It got planted in Poland. It got planted in Spain. It got planted in North Africa and Bavel in America. But it is meant to grow here. This is its native soil, Jerusalem, on the Temple Mount. And the fruit which will bear, planted in its native soil, may not actually bear so much resemblance to what it had in the past. But it is the same fruit.
So I guess what I'd want to ask you, and I forgot to mention this earlier, you started your yeshiva education at the age of 27, mm-hmm. which for my age seems very, very young. Not to Louise. Louise is actually probably about 27. But for me, that's, you know, I realize compared to most, that's a late start. But you've been at it for a while at this point. So I guess what I want to ask you is, do you feel encouraged? Do you feel that the Jewish people are moving in the right direction, that we are growing morally and ethically, that the new Torah that's going to grow now as a result of being back in our land. And I admit I'm saying this as somebody who I want you to encourage me because I'm not feeling that. I identify strongly with a lot of the things you said, but maybe I'm looking in the wrong places, but I don't feel like I'm seeing that. Not by the Rabbanim, not by the community that I live in. And I'm just wondering, you know, help me out here. Maybe you're seeing stuff that I'm not seeing, and we're going to finish really excited about what's coming up next.
So two things. First of all, I would say I absolutely am positive and optimistic. One of the primary images, interestingly, cross-culturally, but certainly within traditional Judaism, is the fact that the seed has to rot in the ground before the plant can grow. And I really believe we live in that era in which
things are rotten, is what you're saying.
Things are rotting. Things are falling apart. All the structures, political, religious, sociological, that have carried us to this point are not adequate to carry us into the future. And yet, we find ourselves in an incredible period of growth. I mean, here we are in Pardes. You know, and I often think about that Pew report that everyone's so grim and the future of American Jewry, which may be true. I don't know. I'm not there. But what I see in my students is an incredible growth. Do I agree with all of it? No. Do I think it's all within, you know, the halakhic structures? No. But the growth alone is awe-inspiring to me. And that's an indication to me that the difficulty that we're in is that difficulty of transition. That's one. But two, and I think on this and a more even empowering level, I want you to think of Mordechai. Mordechai HaYehudi, right? The first Jew, so to speak, as opposed to the Israelite, right? He only gets one line in the whole Megillah. And what does he say to Esther in that fateful moment when she's there in the king's palace and the decree comes down that there is no hope? Haman's going to kill us all. He's in total power. There's no hope. So what does he say? He says two things to her. Revach v'hatzala yamod l'am yehudi m'makom acher. Oh, salvation's going to happen. Don't you worry about the big picture. And this is, we have to hold fast to this bedrock sense that we've had as a people that we're on a mission and there's a promise and that doesn't go away. Okay. But don't forget the other half of what he said. At beit avich, but mi yodea, who knows if this isn't your moment to actually make meaning out of your life. That's the other piece, is that there needs to be an absolute confidence that the world is heading in the right direction, but together with that, a complete dedication to my personal responsibility to make out of every opportunity that God gives me an act of meaning which will push it in the direction I believe it ought to go.
Okay, so I think I'm going to sum up. First of all, this was great, and I want to sum up my takeaways, and then you can, I'm sure that there are many that I need to listen to this podcast myself and learn it again. But number one, sacrifices are not just some ancient relic for a primitive form of worship, but Rav Kook is teaching us that no, it really is addressing a fundamental issue of human sensitivity to cruelty, to how we look at the world around us, and finding gratitude for the material world that we benefit from. And I guess fundamentally, if we're going to eat meat and wear leather clothing, then perhaps offering sacrifices is an appropriate way to remind us both of the limits of our use of the animal world, and to remind us that the animal world can be seen as a gift that we should be grateful for, making our lives easier and more comfortable and more enjoyable. The second piece, this idea of the evolution of human ethics and morality, that we ideally are on a path of getting better. And as we grow, we're also going to change. And therefore, our religious tools and our spiritual tools and how we operate as a people are also going to change and grow. We need to look at that. We need to be consciously aware, where are we headed? Are we getting better? Are we improving? And I think the most aspirational part, that our leadership should be totally plugged into that, that Jewish leadership should always be looking at where we are, where the Torah is, where is Jewish law, and not be afraid to ask those questions. Where are we? What do we need? And how might things be changing? And I'm going to try to take a little bit of your optimism. I don't have a lot of that optimism too often. I think that's my problem. I tend to see things in a darker shade. But I'm excited to hear yours and hopefully learn from it that things are happening. There are new things going on, both here in the land of Israel and outside the land of Israel, and that we need not assume that what always has been is always what's going to be. But we're all growing and changing all at the same time, as you in your own life have grown and changed. Any chance that vegetarianism will be looked at again? Any possibility that there'll be meat in your future?
As soon as we offer the Pesach sacrifice,
I see.
I have already lined up my place in Jerusalem, and I know who's roasting the meat.
Okay. So for those of you who think that the Messianic age is imminent, get ready for Mike Foyer to be saying, please pass the ketchup for my meat sandwich. For those of you who don't, it looks like if you have Mike over, it's going to be tofu, seitan, and other healthy alternatives to all that meat eating. So, Michael, thank you. This has been a privilege. I enjoyed learning with you, and hopefully we'll have opportunities in the future. And thank all of you for listening in.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org. ELMAD.pardes.org.